So modeling without observing is like clapping with one hand. It's hard to make a noise that people can hear. And so that's why we're all here at KITP, is to try and use both hands to see if we can make some progress. And one of the lines of business of my employer, JPL, is launching space telescopes, and so I'll be listening carefully to the discussions for ideas for how we might best be able to make the connection for transport processes in accretion disks. And for this next half hour, I'd like to review some of the observations that protostellar disk modeling has to take into account. I'm going to show some well-known cases to orient the people here who work on other classes of disks, and then also some things that perhaps haven't received as much attention as they ought to, so that hopefully the specialists can get something out of it too. That's right, not yet. So, but disks do form out of these. So this is a molecular cloud complex. The gas and dust that make it up span millions of astronomical units. Within the cloud, a little condensation, maybe only 10,000 astronomical units across, collapses under its own gravity, drags in some amount of the magnetic field that is in the cloud, forms a star and surrounding disk, maybe 100 AU or so across. The disk's outer reaches have temperatures similar to the molecular cloud, so 20 Kelvin or perhaps even less. So the thermal emission from those outer parts peaks at submillimeter wavelengths. Hotter material nearer to the star emits at shorter wavelengths. The hottest dust in at a fraction of an AU is at the sublimation threshold for silicates, and that material emits at around 2 microns. So growing the star in at the center of the disk and forming planets out of the leftovers requires moving material around inside the disk. I mean, planets are not the same composition as the star, for example, so there has to be some differential movement of the materials. So the big question is, how does the stuff move around, and what signatures of the transport can we look for? I would argue, so we've been modeling these disks for decades, and we've come up with lots and lots of ideas for how to move stuff around, and to really distinguish between them, we have to now compare to observations. So the disk's gas is mostly molecular hydrogen, which means it's a poor emitter of any electromagnetic radiation. It's dark. And so the emission from the gas comes mostly from the lines of trace species, molecules like carbon monoxide and water, for example, and also from the disk surface layers, where the ultraviolet radiation from the star breaks the molecules down, excites them, produces atoms and ions. And because of this structure, there are several ways that we could potentially detect gas flows. One is by the kinematics of those trace species whose emission we can see. Another one is by looking at the chemistry of the trace species, seeing that there are chemicals that shouldn't be there if they were in local equilibrium, and that tells you that things have to be being pushed around. And a third method is by the effects of the gas movements on the solid particles that are building planets inside. So this is the structure for the rest of the talk. To begin with, let's look at trace species kinematics. And a big caveat here, which Meredith mentioned some of, is that each trace species only occurs in some range of conditions. For example, carbon monoxide freezes out onto the dust particles at temperatures below maybe 25 Kelvin. So it's not present in the cold parts of the disk in the gas phase that we can see. Carbon monoxide is also destroyed at mass columns less than about 10 to the 21 particles per square centimeter in the disk surface layers by the stellar ultraviolet. So both of these things mean that you'll only see CO in some layer on the surface that's warm but not photodissociated enough. On the other hand, if we're looking at infrared wavelengths, the disk is going to be optically thick even in the continuum in the infrared, and that means we can only see the surface layers of the disk anywhere we look in the infrared. And then if we look at lines that are optically thick, will in fact only see the very top of the layer where the molecule is present. We can't even see down below to the continuum photosphere. So we have to be careful throughout about which part of the disk we're looking at. So Meredith talked in some detail about Teague et al.'s work. So I'll try to pick out the parts that she didn't cover in detail yet. So they did spatially resolved spectroscopy of TW Hydrae using ALMA. And as she mentioned, they are able to get line profiles at any one of many points around the disk. And here are the three transitions that they studied in detail. They picked one very optically thick transition, the carbon monoxide, one transition that has hyperfine structure with a variety of optical depths, the CN, and then one optically thin tracer, the carbon sulfide, which they can combine with the CN, and because they have different atomic weights, they can then infer the turbulent speed. So here are the temperatures that they infer, and the carbon monoxide, as Meredith mentioned, an issue with this method at least is that the temperatures that you get depend on the absolute flux calibration. The CN, there's a problem that the temperatures that you infer, let's see which is the best pointer to use. So the temperatures that you infer from the excitation, they're the blue points here, and they go above the maximum temperature that you would infer if all of the line width is due to temperature and not to turbulence. And so that means that there's some kind of non-LTE excitation of the line out here. So you need a better modeling approach, a more sophisticated modeling approach to extract temperature information out here. And then with the CS, the problem turns out to be that if you use the CN and the CS together, you actually get that their line widths are in the wrong, so in the inner part of the disk, they're in the right sense that the less massive molecule is moving faster, but in the outer part, it's the other way around, which means there's something wrong again. Perhaps the CS and the CN are differently distributed because using this approach, combining the two lines involves an assumption that the two are at the same place in the disk. So perhaps that breaks down. So they do get, as Meredith showed, they do get turbulent line widths as a function of position, but they conclude that those are only upper limits and that our knowledge of the thermal structure of the disk is still a big limiting factor. So we need to fit more lines, we need to include a non-LTE transfer in order to really get some information out of this about the turbulence. Another way to infer kinematics is using infrared lines. And here are measurements of the CO rho vibrational fundamental lines near 5 microns in the infrared by Joanna Brown and company using VLT. So there's several dozen T Tauri stars that they've looked at here at very high spectral resolution. So they have a resolution of, I think, about 100,000. And the key thing here is that while there are a few examples where you see the double peaked profiles like the ones that Meredith showed in the millimeter wavelengths, there are only a few. Many of them have these narrow, tall central peaks. And that's a surprise because if we thought that the CO was distributed in some ring in the disk, there should be one side of the ring coming towards us and giving a blue shifted side and one side going away and giving a red shifted side, so we should get this double peak. But for some reason, there is extra emission near the star's own velocity. Brown and company also looked for extended emission in these lines, and in most of the systems they looked at, they didn't see it. So that means that this low velocity emission can't be stuff orbiting slowly in the very outer parts of the disk. So they said that this must mean that the low velocity gas is in a wind. But I must say I don't understand that because, so here's a nice diagram that Geoffroy Lazur made a while ago. So this is showing the disk here, the star, and here's a magnetic field line coming out from its launching point on the disk surface. So if we imagine that we're launching a wind here, because the field line is stiff, in this picture, the wind rotates at the orbital frequency of its launching point until it gets out far enough that the field line is able to bend, and then we get slower material. So this stuff is orbiting even faster in terms of velocity than its foot point until it gets out to here. And I would have guessed that by the time we get out to here, the CO would already be destroyed by the stellar ultraviolet. So I haven't seen a detailed model trying to relate a wind picture like this to these narrow central peaks, but this seems like something that should be done to see whether in the infrared we are detecting the wind or not. It's a mystery where the low velocity material is to me. Another thing that we can do at high spectral resolution is look at spectropolarimetry to get some constraints on the magnetic field in the disk, one of the key things if magnetic forces are driving the transport. And this is from work by Jean-Francois Donati and company, and they find that the Stokes V parameter varies across the line center in a way and with a strength that's consistent with a field of a few tens of Gauss in close to the star where the lines that they're looking at are forming. Now there are several caveats to this, so in order to get even this rather noisy looking profile, they had to combine many, many lines across the optical and near infrared, and those probably are forming at different locations in the disk. They had a rather simple model for how the temperature varied across this region. And they're looking at an atypical source, FU Orionis, which is having a major accretion outburst. So for all these reasons, so while this paper has been cited over the years, it hasn't, the observations, this kind of measurement, as far as I know, has not been repeated, which is surprising because this is exactly the parameter that theorists would love to know. And so the fact that it hasn't been done again makes me wonder whether this was a real detection, or I don't know. It's a little bit mysterious to me.
I think they got the magnetic field was also over a narrow region in the line profile, so it was weird, very weird.
Uh-huh. Are you aware of any follow-up measurement?
No.
Mm-hmm. The instrument still exists. It's been around for more than a decade, I think. I look forward to that. So a second way we can look for transport processes is by their effects on the trace species. And this, I have to say, is a little bit unsatisfying because it turns out to be model dependent. There are usually more than one, there's usually more than one way to produce similar kinds of chemical signatures with different transport processes or different strengths for the processes, because you're balancing them against chemical reactions whose rates you don't know well, or you don't even know which pathway is the right one, for example. So I'm just going to consider one case, so, and that is cold water. So these are from Herschel observations by Hoegerheide and company, and models had predicted that the water should be a fairly booming signal, but when it was eventually detected, it was quite weak. I think maybe I've seen three sources where there were these detections of the cold water in the outer disks, and in all cases it's very weak. The line flux is, I think, more than order of magnitude less than had been expected. So here's one of the models that accounts for that from Sebastian Kreit and company. So this is a time series. The time in years is up there in white, going up to about 10 to the 4 years. And then each of these little circles is a representative dust particle in this annulus of the disk. And the color of the circle represents how much water it has. So if it's red, it's only 1/1000th ice, whereas if it's dark blue, it could be even mostly ice. And then the background colors are showing the vapor, the water vapor. And you can see that over time, what happens is that the water-bearing particles settle down into the interior and the atmosphere becomes depleted in water vapor. So that's consistent with the observations. But there are other models, for example, that involve the water being photo-destroyed in the atmosphere and they're not being able to reform because of chemical effects on grain surfaces. And so it's not clear to me that we get a very strong constraint on the strength of the turbulence or whatever else is doing the transport. So the third general kind of signature that I'd like to talk about is the effects of the transport on the solid particles. And the first and clearest signature is that you do see dust particles in the disk atmosphere. So here's an edge-on protostellar disk. So we're seeing starlight scattered by the dust in the atmosphere above and below the mid-plane.
That's infall, you know. That's an infalling envelope. That's not, you know, I mean, at some point you get to the disk, but that stuff way out there is part of the envelope of the protostar.
I may have chosen a poor example because this is a relatively young system, but certainly there are others where it's older and you do still see the dust. And so again, relying on models, if you calculate how quickly you expect the dust to evolve, to stick together with other particles and to sink to the mid-plane, it's quick. It's maybe 1% of the lifetime of the disks. And so something is keeping the dust suspended in the atmosphere. Perhaps even something has to be breaking up bigger particles in order to produce small ones to return them to the atmosphere. So turbulence can probably do that if it's strong enough. A wind may be able to do that. I don't think we know that very well yet. Another kind of signature that we can see is from comparing the distributions of the gas and dust. So here's from work by Sean Andrews and company using SMA to look at TW Hydrae. And so here are visibility curves, and the key thing to look at is down here. So the one model that fits the resolution of the interferometer here is a power law, one particular power law that as you go away from the star, the millimeter continuum drops off and then cuts off suddenly, so it goes to zero suddenly at some radius. That's the best fitting model for the continuum, meaning for the dust particles, the millimeter-sized dust particles. And the power law has to be relatively steep, r to the minus 1.5. But if you look in the gas at CO J equals 3 to 2, the best fitting model is not that same cutoff power law, but one here that has a shallower slope and also has an extended exponential tail at the outside. And so the dust is more compact and has a sharp outer edge. So this is telling you something about the way the dust and gas have decoupled, which is in turn telling you something about transport processes. It also means that we have to be very careful when converting continuum fluxes to surface densities, which people still do. So we've seen this beautiful image. I was at a conference a year or so ago where I was told that anybody who showed this picture had to buy a round of drinks. But sorry, I can't afford that. It's been shown so many times. So as Meredith mentioned, so the rings are very thin. They have to be thin because if they were thick, then given our somewhat inclined view of the system, they should be overlapping one another. We wouldn't see the clean dark ring between the bright rings, and that requires turbulent speeds less than about 1% of the sound speed. But we don't know yet whether the rings are from gaps cleared by planets, perhaps they're sublimation distances from the star where the dust abundance abruptly changes or where dust aggregates break up. They could be sintering thresholds in the model of Okazumi that we heard about. They could be places where dust particles are collecting because there are gas pressure maxima into which the particles tend to drift. I did a literature search now more than a year ago for a meeting in Yokohama for models of this object, and there at that time were already 40 different models, so the number has not decreased. So it's telling us something about transport, but I don't think we know yet. Another ALMA observation that's come out since is this one from Lara Perez and company. And the claim, you can see it better with unsharp masking, but I preferred to show the original image, is that there are spiral arms here and here, in addition to this more axisymmetric part in the center. And so one claim that's been made is this is due to, these spiral arms are made by gravitational instability, but that is not universally accepted. But this can potentially give us some constraints on transport. Yet another case where we may be seeing some evidence for transport processes at millimeter continuum wavelengths is, or submillimeter, are these early ALMA observations from Ninka van der Marel and company. And here, so the submillimeter ALMA data is this blob here, which is offset from the star. And if you compare the surface brightness here with the other side, it's more than a factor of 100 different. So the millimeter particles which are producing this emission have to be highly concentrated on one side of the star. And the model that seems to be most popular is one involving a large vortex, perhaps driven by heating and cooling, or perhaps driven by the pressure gradient that you get at the edge of a large central clearing that's seen in this disk. It's not certain. If you look at the gas in CO6-5, you see that it is more symmetric around the star. You see a blue shifted and a red shifted wing. The gas is just like you would expect for a regular disk. And if you look at smaller dust particles, they also are more axisymmetric and distributed quite unlike the millimeter particles. And that's also consistent with some kind of a vortex concentrating the bigger sand grain sized bits. But perhaps this system is special because it does have that central clearing. Perhaps different shapes of disk have different transport processes. So we have probable detections of gas flows by each of these three pathways, but we haven't yet solidly, in my view, linked any one of those detections to a transport mechanism. So theorists need the courage to test our ideas. It's not just about coming up with the ideas. We need to make falsifiable predictions, and when they don't work out, be ready to consider possibilities beyond what we had explored so far. And the observers have to be willing to ask theorists to explain themselves clearly and to call them out on the nuttier stuff that they come up with. So we've seen that each transport process has a characteristic signature. The disk weather produces vortices. Gravitational instability makes spiral arms, spiral shocks. Magnetocentrifugal disk winds produce a cold helical outflow, at least cold relative to its ultimate velocity. And MRI turbulent eddies are transonic near the disk surface, but perhaps other things are also close to the sound speed there. Can we distinguish those different possibilities? So I'd like to look in a bit more detail at a couple of specific cases. One of them is how we might want to tell winds from MRI turbulence using the infrared kinematic signatures. And here, so we heard a little bit from Meredith about how this is being done already at millimeter wavelengths, but in the infrared, we need to do this too. We need to take the output from dynamical models, we need to compute synthetic observations so that we can compare them in detail with what's seen. But it's not going to be easy to model the non-LTE excitation of models that are being, of molecules that are being broken up photochemically in the disk atmosphere. So we'll hear more about that from Joan tomorrow. This is a big challenge, I think, in making the most out of the information that's in the infrared spectra. I see things. In the millimeter continuum, it now looks like axisymmetric rings are fairly common, but they're not universal. There are other things happening too. Does that mean that different transport processes dominate in different systems? Or perhaps, since we're looking at millimeter continuum here, does this just mean that the evolution of the dust is different in different cases? The people that model these continuum images could ask more often, I think, how the particles evolve in their size distribution and in their movements relative to the gas, in order to relate this to transport processes more closely. And we need to consider more than just one transport scenario. We have to do more than just use the alpha disk. We have to compare turbulence of different kinds, hydrodynamical sources of turbulence as well as magnetic ones, and disk winds as well as turbulence, and really see how they differ detectably. So here is the outline, and it's also the summary. So thank you, and I look forward to our discussions this week.
Plenty of time for questions. Lee.
This may be crazy, but those peaky CO profiles look like magnetospheric infall profiles to me.
Wouldn't that mean high velocities?
They get very... Yes, you get high velocity wings.
So like, look at RU Loopy, right? You get things that are kind of out to high velocities, but you get a lot of stuff at low velocity.
I see.
It's a completely different profile than a wind thing.
So another thing that Brown et al. Mention is that in an average sense, the blue sides of the wings are, of the line wings are a little bit stronger. So that is some evidence for a wind of that kind.
Well, you also get that with magnetospheric infall because you have absorption on the infall side.
Yep.
Actually, just following on.
Sorry.
Yeah, just following on from that. Do you know if these are optically thin or optically thick?
Surely they're optically thick.
So if they're optically thick, couldn't that, I mean, so there's classic papers by people like Murray and Chiang and accreting white dwarfs and quasars, which basically point out that you can make single peak line profiles from rotating disks if you have a disk wind, even if the wind is actually much slower than the rotation profile. What matters is the shear. It's the gradient of the velocity profile that matters for optically thick lines. And that is does a nice job of basically, essentially what you tend to do is remove the line wings from the double peak lines and turn the double peak lines into single peak lines. There's lots of papers on this in other fields, so this might be a mechanism that works here.
That's interesting. I'd like to know more about that, but are they considering a similar...
I will show some examples and perhaps you can get a bit more illustrations of this effect.
Okay, that sounds helpful.
In this case as well.
Okay, I mean, one factor that I'm interested to hear whether it applies there is the photoionization, so the destruction of the emitting molecules at a certain height in the outflow.
Right, but the effect that Christian is referring to and Murray and Chiang emphasize, we are talking about the regions where the velocity, poloidal velocity is relatively small, so this is the effect near the disk wind, this is in the wind base. What we are talking about here is acceleration in the radial direction, where the velocity itself is still quite small.
I see. Okay.
So it could work.
Okay.
Other questions?
So this may be a question to you or to Meredith, that in the disks, you're now seeing these rings quite clearly. And so anything like a parametric power law temperature distribution is clearly not describing the data. Would you like to comment on how that's going to change our understanding of turbulence?
Well, yes. So, I mean, the calculations up to now have mostly been isothermal, or at least vertically isothermal. I think some of the disk wind calculations are now including a vertical temperature gradient. I think
this
more
is plainly a sharp radial transition, nothing like a nice smooth background profile. That's the sort of thing you'd obviously start with.
Sure. I mean, I think when you're talking about, is this on? I don't know.
It should be.
Okay.
Green light's on.
So when you're talking about temperature in taking it from the rings that you're seeing in continuum, I think a couple of points are important to remember. While the dust does play a role in heating the gas, the dust temperature is not necessarily equal to the gas temperature. Interestingly, one thing that you should definitely ask Kevin about is the rings that we're also seeing in DCO plus. So, but it's not clear whether, HG16296, which is one of these disks that we've been fitting, has rings in continuum. it also has rings in DCO plus that are in different places than the continuum rings. So it seems like maybe a chemical effect is changing the abundances. I think the gas temperature, though, is probably not well traced by looking at the dust rings in these disks. Now, if they're caused by planets, Ilse's here, and she can definitely tell you about what happens if you have a planet embedded in the disk and accretion onto the planet, which changes the temperature, which can change the chemistry locally in these gas disks. But we're not, on the large scales in the outer disk of HD162296, we're not seeing any of those effects. So, I mean, I think at this point, the approximation where we're taking the temperature profiles that are made to match up with the really detailed calculations by like Paolo D'Alessio, and we're taking parametric approximations of those temperature profiles where you have the heating happening on the surface of the gas disk and then going towards the colder midplane are probably pretty good, although we definitely need more data to understand that. I'll also point out that we that if there were radial discontinuities in the temperature, they should show up in the line ratios when we have these multiple transitions of CO, which we do have, and we're not seeing any evidence of that yet, although we don't have quite as high angular resolution in the gas as the dust. So it's something to keep in mind going forward, but I'm not too concerned just on the basis of the rings that we're seeing in HL tau at this point.
But so a contrary point of view maybe is from the scattered light observations of several disks where there seem to be rings, so that scattered light meaning that's at the disk surface, and the rings there suggest a difference in the stellar illumination with distance from the star, and if that's the main input for the heating, then that suggests that there, I don't know what amplitude, but perhaps there is some radial rippling in the temperature. Yes, agreed.
A very nice presentation, Neil. I was intrigued by your suggestion that we might use the fluffiness of disks as a probe of turbulence. You also showed how like large grains may have settled to the midplane and have very orderly sort of motion without the turbulence, but maybe in the surface, small grains persist, and the fact that they're still there might be a signature of turbulence. That seems pretty nice if that's a clean signature. What do you think are the major caveats to that argument?
So you're asking what are the caveats to grains remaining in the surface layers being a signature of turbulence?
Yeah.
Well, I would say we dust bunnies are a messy business, and so perhaps we don't know as well as we think we do how easily dust coagulates and settles out of sight.
So you think the grain settling times may not be as short as people think?
I think the grain growth times may not be as short as people think. But I would just say that's the biggest uncertainty. I think because there's orders of magnitude of leeway, and so we would need to be very wrong about that in order to have the disks be completely free of any stirring motion and yet have the dust persist. It's not impossible, but it seems unlikely to me.
So I can sort of comment on that because we've been thinking about this, is that one of the things we're seeing in the chemical community is that when we look at carbon monoxide and we try to determine the disk gas mass, we get a about an order of magnitude difference. Either all the disks have dust to gas ratios that are on there about a unity or maybe 10 as opposed to 100, or the carbon monoxide abundance is lower. And you know, right, I come from the side where I claim it's lower, but one other thing that may play into this would be the disk gas mass then, right? If you have lower gas mass, maybe you need higher turbulence perhaps to loft things up or something like that. So that might be one of the more important degeneracies in trying to untangle what Joan was getting at.
Mm-hmm. It's just a comment to a thread that was posted a few questions ago. Okay, you said about the thermal structure of these wings that they are not known. Okay, they are known, they are published, and there are work published with different assumptions on the temperature distribution on the wind, on whether it is a polytrop, it is isothermal, or whatever. So this exists.
So
I can pass you the references if you wish.
Sure. So for protostellar disk winds, the models that I'm familiar with, so for example, people were debating recently over whether the wind is being launched mostly by the stellar ultraviolet or by the stellar X-rays, which penetrate to different depths, heat in different locations, and that affects the temperature structure and the mass outflow rate.
Okay, but you are talking about sonic winds launched by photo, you're talking about photoevaporative flows. Am I right?
There are many models, is my impression, but at least some of them, yes, it's sonic. There are others where it's perhaps sonic at the launch point and then magnetic.
Exactly. So what I am talking is about those magnetic, the hydromagnetic, these winds.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have the low temperature to whatever.
I see. I'd be interested to hear more
okay,
about
that. Okay, so we can talk about that during this day.
I see. Thank you.
To make our discussion a little bit more turbulent, I would like to ask a question to both our speakers. What do we mean by turbulence in this context? Is this something which is not thermal broadening, or it's more something more specific that you have in mind?
Well, it gets fuzzy. For example, if you're thinking about magnetorotational turbulence in the disk atmosphere, its wavelength gets longer and longer, because the Alfvén speed gets bigger, and if an eddy is high in the atmosphere is comparable in size to the distance from the star, is that still turbulence, or is that an irregularity in the wind? I mean, there's a fine line, I think.
Yeah, I don't have a microphone, but I'm happy to confirm that what we are. I'm happy to confirm that what we are measuring, what we're calling turbulence in our models, is basically exactly what you were suggesting, is we're essentially subtracting out all of the other sources of broadening. We're fitting for the turbulent broadening and the rotational broadening and the optical depth broadening and all of these different things. And then whatever's left, we're calling turbulence, but it would be totally fair to call it non-thermal broadening. Also keeping in mind that right now we're not really measuring any at all, so we're not finding that we need any non-thermal broadening. so that would be my answer to your question from the model fitting to data point of view.
Another thing that's worth keeping in mind is that different ways of driving the turbulence may produce different anisotropy ellipsoids, which could be another useful diagnostic if we can ever access those. So for example,
dissipation level, or not necessarily?
Yes. What Lee said.
Neil, I was interested in the implications of the slide that you had about the depletion of water from the upper surfaces of disks. So I don't know that model very well. I just wonder if you could comment on what the ingredients are and what's to be taken from that model with regards to also thinking about how much turbulence might be there, because you've got these very blue grains settling towards the midplane, and clearly if there was a significant turbulent flow there, you might think that they would get lofted back up into the atmosphere where they could potentially be heated such that they replenish the amount of water vapor and therefore raise the amount of water you'd expect to see. So just interested to hear if you know what goes into these models and what the implications are for the amount of turbulent mixing.
Well, I think we have one of the co-authors here.
There we go. Whilst I'm on the subject, Ted, because I was going to ask a follow-up question as well. So we have these observations of millimeter dust grains, which seem to be more compact in their spatial distribution in protoplanetary disks than the gases. Do we also have constraints on the degree of vertical settling of those grains relative to their radial distribution as well? So there's two questions there. What went into this model, and what constraints do we have on the settling of larger grains?
So, I'll answer the second question first. I mean, the constraints are, for the most part, I think, model from models right now that the grains are highly settled. There are, I know, observations in existence of some edge-on disks where this has been shown that they that you know, confirms the suggestion that they are settled. Now, as far as this model goes, what it is a model where you start with a grain size distribution, you know, MRN distribution, and you let the grains coagulate and grow, including fragmentation. And then what's perturbing, the growth happens at all levels, but the settling occurs, okay? And as you settle down, you could potentially be lofted back up by turbulence, right? So turbulence is the thing that's counteracting the settling of bigger grains, right? So as you grow with the upper layers, you sink a little bit and you're kept up by turbulence, and then as you go down, you may get big enough that you would hit the fragmentation speed, you know, when you get about centimeter size, that could break you apart again and loft you back up. And so what we were trying to see is, you know, for given values of turbulence, could you or would you deplete the water vapor from the upper atmosphere? The way I like to think about this is if you're concentrating all the dust mass in the midplane, and if the dust grains are coated with ices, then you likely are concentrating the ice mass in the midplane. And we were just trying to see whether that was true in a detailed model. And a final point is that the Hoger-Heide paper is out. We have another paper with a survey from Herschel of cold water emission. And essentially, whatever this effect is, it's universal. There's like we have 10 to 15 disks where we see essentially no water vapor emission. And the normal models would predict that it should be there.
But that means, given your dust evolution model, what constraints were you able to put onto the
So we didn't work it back that way, but we could look at that. Yeah, that was not done.
Just a quick comment on the model dependence of inference of settling. The millimeter fluxes in spectra suggest that you have millimeter dust particles present, right? But if you mix them up into the upper layers, you would never see the 10 micron silicate emission feature, right? Because you have to have much smaller grains in order to still see that feature. And the fact that it's an emission tells you that you're seeing the upper layers where you've got a temperature inversion. So it is model inference, but it's really hard to get around that. No. I mean, if we use a full, if you use an MRN power law, okay, and you extend it out to a millimeter, you won't see that feature gets wiped out.
One more question.
So the nice rings formed in these protoplanetary disks. What time scale do they form, or? Do we know that what time scale do they form and what radial width varies from the central radius?
I heard part of it. So the free fall time scale for the condensation in the molecular cloud to collapse is about 10 to the 5 years. And then the disk lives for perhaps a few million years after that. Is there more to the question? Or?
Yeah. Okay, I think we have a half hour break now. We'll return at 11. Let's thank the speaker.